thank you very much, and thank you very much for the invitation. I'm glad we could get together and have a chat, and I hope that's what it will be. This title actually came out of the meeting that Joan and I were in at the Information Futures Institute, where we had very interesting conversations with Harvard academics about what is the future of libraries. And it started with this comment made about, imagine if we could come out with a free ebook reader or something really cheap that was actually fun to read, that was connected all the time to the internet and you could get any book on. Wouldn't that radically change the world of books and libraries? To which my response was, it would radically change the world of books. And then we get into a very interesting discussion about why or wouldn't it change the world of libraries and librarianship. And it was a very, you know, it's one of those really mad conversations. And as I told the group there, I said there's two things that really make me mad. One is sort of pseudoscience and specious use of logic. Read anything that Bill O'Reilly says. And we're in Washington. I can be political. And the other is when I am to blame for something. I demonstrated this very well. You know, if my wife comes in and says something like, "Dave, you've been on the road. You know, you're cheating on me, clearly," I can just laugh that off. If she comes in and says, "Didn't I ask you to do those dishes last night?" I'm like, "Damn dishes? I don't know where they are." And so it really became, I think, what was making me angry about this conversation is that as a field, we hadn't really had a nice response to that comment as a field. You know, what was interesting is a lot of people would say, "Oh, it's going to put libraries out of business." And those were librarians saying that. And they was going to say, "Oh, no, it doesn't matter. Books are irrelevant." And it was like 50 different messages going back. And it was, "Oh, my God, this field is splintering." And it made me really spend some time thinking about the future of libraries. At the same time, we've been doing work with the MacArthur Foundation, and the MacArthur Foundation said, you know, we're working on this stuff on digital youth and literacy, and we seem to keep getting sucked back into libraries. It's like, you know, we didn't ever intend to, and yet now everyone who's talking about informal education starts talking about public libraries. And then the work I was doing with them was on credibility. And so we were talking about credibility and what's credible information. They said, you know, we're doing this work on credibility, and we keep getting sucked into libraries as potential partners and as credible agents and such. Maybe we should do a little thinking about what kind of partners could libraries be in the future and where they're headed and what that future is. Now, I noticed that a lot of the theme for this series is on thinking in the future and trends. And I want to start with one of the things that, so they came to me in May and said, "We would love you to prepare an extensive, exhaustive, thorough report on the future of libraries, and we'd like it next month." So it brought home to me, you know, as an academic, we learn very quickly the importance of the question. So for those of you who don't know, this is Douglas Adams. And the famous thing, he wrote Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. By the way, I'm an obnoxious New York professor. Can everyone hear me all right if I don't stand next to the microphone? Is that all right? Okay. So in Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, you know, these wonderful transdimensional aliens develop the biggest, most wonderful, powerful machine in the world, and they ask it, "What is the meaning of life, the universe, and everything?" And after a couple of million years of crunching on that, it comes up with 42. To which they say, "Really?" You know, and the computer says, "Well, the problem is, I can give you the answer, but I can't give you the question." And it really is going to take the question to understand what that means. And then they build Earth, and hilarity ensues, and a really bad movie adaptation ensues. So how you ask the question, what question you ask, matters. Whether you're asking the question about the future, whatever it is, we try to teach doctoral students about that. For example, when you're doing research on a dissertation, never ask a yes or no question, because it doesn't help. I mean, you know, does the library improve performance of academics in their research? Yes. I mean, it's great to say yes. Is the answer because they're coming in and this is a great place to get coffee? Is the answer because, you know, libraries inspire them as they walk by the front of it? Or, you know, is it the services we actually perform? So asking yes and no questions, not really helpful. So the first task that I went through and that I would recommend that you folks go through as you're thinking towards the future is to get the question right. And so here's the question that I was given. What is the future of libraries? It's a bad question. And I'll tell you why in a little bit. But actually, I started with this question, and so I would call up friends and colleagues and academics and public librarians and academic librarians and special librarians, and I would say, what is the future of libraries? And invariably, the question they would ask back to me would be, in public libraries, in academic libraries, in special libraries, in rural libraries, in urban libraries, in one-person libraries, in school libraries, and, you know, but what's also amazing is there was actually a pretty unified answer to it after we got through that initial dating. And that was what emerged was a common vision. That if you go around the field, there really is a sense of a common vision. So it seems like I'm giving you the answer and we can go kick off and have some more cookies, but I want to walk through it some more. Librarians. First of all, when you talk about what is the future of librarians or libraries, almost invariably people came back to, are you really talking about the future of librarians? And what's interesting is that within shorthand, I think we often know when we mean, even though we say the word libraries, we sort of in our mind translate when that means building, when that means us. But a lot of people outside the field don't. A lot of people outside the field don't. And if you've ever, you've never had this circumstance, but if you're wearing a tie in a library, you're a librarian, right? So one of the common themes as a field, primarily practitioners, but scholars were looking at this, they were saying librarians. When we have to look at the future, we have to talk about the future of librarians. Their skills, preparation, and their keys are key to the future of libraries. We have to worry about how we're training our workforce, how diverse it is in terms of both ethnic, but also in terms of skills. And this really got, I don't talk about it too much in this presentation, but it really turned into a rather interesting conversation about how we prepare librarians. With one person saying, the 50-year experiment in master's level preparation of librarians has failed. And he was like a former dean. And it's really interesting, because if you think about it, like I say, I'll just take a moment. We expect that people out of 2 years of their life, one point in their life, are then qualified to be webmaster, reference librarian, cataloger, human resources manager, director of libraries, without any necessity for continuing education. Also, if we look at what we prepare folks for in library school, we prepare them everything from putting shelves, well, actually, sometimes putting shelves up and putting books on shelves to developing the next XML schema and metadata schema to developing leadership institutes and things. We ask them really to do everything from real grunt work up to really sophisticated technology and really sophisticated leadership all out of this one experience. So I'll just leave that one alone for now. We'll come back to it later. All right. The library as place came up as a theme. We're not getting rid of the buildings anytime soon, but the nature of the library as place is changing from a different role. Instead of the library being sort of warehouse and materials and central access point, to becoming more of a trusted community space with ample opportunities for learning and discourse. In other words, rather than the quiet shush space, this is the place to come hang out. And we spend a lot of time with cafes and comfortable seating and rearranging things to really ensure that. And many places, I was at Brooklyn College, and Brooklyn College has a whole wing, well, it's really like this amount of space, which is just carrels with lots of power next to it and privacy dividers. I mean, the entire part of that facility is just a place to sit and recharge a battery. Right? So it's interesting. Education and learning will be at the core of library services. Not a lot of discussion of access. Not a lot of discussion of collection. A lot of discussion on learning and education. The fact that the information world is increasingly digital and that librarians have a strong role in helping make sense of that digital world for their patrons. We realize that library place is important. We very much realize that there are fiber optic lines running all throughout this world and carrying the day-to-day data, and we have a place in that world. They need for better data, methods for determining the impact of library work. We need real data that we can hold on to evaluate our service on a regular and ongoing and easily usable way. The idea of these monolithic studies that come out with terabytes of data about what our patrons think about us, and we're handed the executive summary, and this is enough for us to truly determine the influence and future direction of our service is done. We need to have the ability to go in and say, well, you know, here's Google Maps. What I want to see is a per capita spending or per capita borrowing of this region versus this region, like, and to just, in a really few clicks, be able to do some sophisticated data analysis. I was at a library, and I love this library, because it is the first library I ever went into that didn't talk about resource crunch. And by the way, I've worked, there's the trick. If you ever want to sound smart, what you do is you keep working from domain to domain to domain and just repeat the thing from the last domain. Right? So I go from education to transportation. I tell transportation what education learned. They go, oh, you're smart, Dave. Yes, I am. And then I'll move to medicine. And in every field I've been in, I have never heard, boy, we have more money and time than we know what to do with. But this is the library I walked into, and the library literally said, we don't have a problem. If we want a resource, we get it. The idea of we have to pick between a digital and paper, nah, get them both. Right? It was bizarre. But what was really interesting is this led to a very data-poor environment. They had no data. When I asked them what their user size of their user community was, they couldn't tell me. When I asked them what the average borrowing was, they had no idea. How many hits on the website? I don't know. Because they didn't have to. Because they never had to sort of marshal it to make that case. What's interesting is it turned into how they make the decision is a lot like Dave yelled loudest. Give it to Dave. And it turned into a very personality-driven environment, which worked great for them because they had good personalities. But we've all been in situations where that might not work so well. Right? So we need better data. We need better data that we can take and make actionable. And by the way, the other side of this is, just as an aside, alert to be weary of the demagoguery that happens in our profession, of which I'm probably most to blame for, right? That we get these sort of personality and people can get up and sound really exciting and really passionate, tell us the direction we're going in, and we don't stop to say, now why? What's the theoretical standpoint or what's the data standpoint? How can you back that up? And I think we're going to see that in a little bit. That federal and global policies on things like intellectual property, openness of government and privacy outside of the library will have a huge impact in what we do. That we can dream of the perfect vision of what a library needs to be, but if we are ignorant of the fact that we live in a world that has all these competing interests, it could be changed tomorrow. Let's face it, if fair use disappeared, a lot of the justification of libraries, not just in the public sector, but very much in the academic sector, would be threatened. Right? So when Digital Millennia Copyright Act comes together, we can't just say, oh, that's fine, we don't care, it's a policy thing, because it has direct influences to where we are. If you're in the music collection business these days, you know the hell of digital rights management. You know that there's a good amount of music you'll never get on physical medium, and it's illegal for you to even break the encryption to make sure it's available for a generation from us. These things matter. Now, the other thing I'd like to point out about this common vision, once again, coming from all across, is before these words were said, not necessarily exactly these words, but these concepts were said, it started like this. Call up an academic library director. Hello, academic library director. Please, what is the future of libraries? Well, I can't talk about public, because they're screwed. But it's pretty bright for academic libraries, because it's all about education and public community spaces. Call up public library director. Hello, public library director. What is the future of libraries? Well, I can't tell you about academic. They're screwed. But for us, it's all about education and public community spaces. In other words, I was hearing the same thing. Right? And the special libraries, they were really out of it, unless, of course, you were talking to a special librarian, in which case they were doing just fine. This concept that we've taken the tools, the reductionist tools that we use to organize our collections in the world of knowledge and turned it on ourselves is a problem. We constantly question innovations that come from other librarians. What's interesting is we question the innovations that come from other library types more than we question innovations that come from outside of the library profession to begin with. So if, you know, God help us, the D.C. public libraries have a really interesting program. Oh, they're a public library. Google, yeah, whatever they're up to. Right? I mean, we've come to this situation. The other thing that became very clear upon looking, and by the way, it gets more optimistic and promising, but never start there. the domination of technology. Put bluntly, technology and trends in the information industry are dominating discussions of the future of libraries and drowning out the more profound discussion of how libraries can be trusted sources of information in the proper functioning of society. I think all too often when we bring up the future, it's like my opening graphic. We assume robots and flying cars. And we don't, true innovation. If you want to truly capture what is that thing in the future, it's that thing that will seem so boring we won't pay attention to it when it happens. Right? The idea of the telephone. I mean, in 1800s, the telephone was a radical concept, and now we don't even think about it. It's the telephone. It's the light switch. It's the this. Right? It's not going to be, the future is going to look a lot more like us than it's going to look radically different from us because we're going to create it. So why is it that we constantly equate future with technology? Clearly, technology is a massive part of what's going to influence it, but I would argue that it's only one factor that's going to influence it. Policy is going to influence it more. Demographics. Demographics are going to trump technology at every level. You want to talk about a massive shift that's happened in our field, we can talk about Google. We can talk about the web. But we should also talk about the fact that in the past century, the average life expectancy has raised from 40 to 78 in the United States population. That baby boomers are about to retire en masse. And if you look at the strategic direction of, I don't know, a university setting, suddenly they're going, 18-year-olds are cool, but 65-year-olds are rich. Right? Tell me you don't have a senior program of some sort in this library, in this university. This is going to be a major factor. The notion that we need to begin to shift and break away from the world as 3-credit semester-long boxes and think of it as a continuous learning cycle is a massive shift. And yeah, that continuous learning cycle may happen in Wikipedia and online, but the point is it's the learning cycle that's radically new. A lot of what we need to talk about with technology is that it is catching up to how we learn and think, not us trying to come up with new ways of learning and thinking. So, how would I started with the idea that this is a horrible question, right? It's too broad. It opens itself up for all of our sort of neuroses because we can begin to slice and dice and which library and what do you mean and what all that. And so I'm going to give you what I think are some possible refinements to this question and the refinements I used in this MacArthur study. The first is, instead of what is the future of libraries, talking about what should be the future of libraries. Now, I gathered together my esteemed colleagues in Syracuse and we were sitting around a table and we were saying, what is the future of libraries? And it's this and it's that and it's this. And they're academic, they're faculty members. So it's ultimately, clearly my research agenda is the future of libraries. No, my research agenda is the future of libraries. The old joke, how many faculty members does it take to change a light bulb? One, they hold up the bulb and wait for the world to revolve around them. As a faculty member, I can say this joke. What should be the future of libraries or what is? Because as we were talking about it, a doctoral student said, well, is that, what do we say? We want to know what is it or what it should be. We thought about that for a minute. Do you want to know what is the future of libraries? Do you want to know if we do nothing, what's going to happen? Do you want to know, for example, if I had great data that said this Cambridge scholar was right and that, in fact, libraries are going to be closed in 20 years, are you okay with that answer? If we really talked about what is the future of libraries, well, the future of libraries is Danielle Steele novels and DVDs. It's the alternative to Blockbuster. Is that an answer we're comfortable with? The future of libraries is study carols upon study carols upon study carols for students and not a librarian in the place. Are we okay with that answer? Here's the thing. The future is great. Someone wants to define time as one damn thing after another. It's going to happen, right? And we could sit back and just sort of let it happen. Or we could build trends and watch it happen. And sometimes we say, oh, don't worry, the director will figure out the vision and we'll implement it. This is a problem. Every member of the library community, every librarian needs to be asking this question and needs to argue and needs to fight and needs to think about it, needs to be proactive. Because there was a very interesting conversation now among these faculty members saying, all right, is it our job to think about what should be the future or what is the future? So here's, and you say, well, what's the difference? Well, I can come into the library environment and do huge surveys. I can have an N of some extraordinary number. I can have my quantitative methods and unquestionable statistical methods. And I can come in and without a doubt I can report some p-value of confidence in significance of variable Y or X. And that's good scholarship. But does it matter? If you don't take that answer and turn it into an agenda for action, preferences, suggestions, if you don't work within the community, say, you know what? It turns out this huge demographic shift is happening. Here's what you should do about it. Have we really done our job as faculty members? Now, this is a philosophical debate that we can have. I would argue it's much less of a philosophical debate that you're allowed to have as librarians, which is to take that information and make a difference. So when someone comes up to you and they don't know a thing at the reference desk, is it okay for you to send that student away stupid? If someone comes up to you and says, I just need this article, I don't know, I know anything else about this article, do you hand them the article and let them walk away? Or do you say, you know, part of my function in academic library is teaching. I want to know why they need it so I can teach them how to find the next one or know this difference or whatever. Why do we build instructional services? Why do we do instruction within a library unless we think it is our job to improve the academy, the student body, the faculty, in how they use and absorb information? It is this proactive nature that we should be considering when we talk about what is our future. We need to get off of talking about what's going to happen to us and start talking about what we are going to make happen. And that responsibility belongs with each of us, from the reference desk and cataloging minions to the directors and the outreach people and every step in between. It is all of our responsibilities to envision that future and to have that conversation and do it in a proactive way. We are over the fear and loathing of Google days. 10 years ago, I keep underestimating things because I hate to admit I'm getting older, but call it 7. Yeah, split the difference. 7 years ago, if we were having the future of libraries conversation, you've all been to the conferences. You've all been to the Google conferences. What Google Scholar means to us, what Google book scanning means to us, what Google searching means to us. In other words, we're defining our entire future by what Google left behind. We don't have that conversation anymore. When I was having this call around to all these people, no one had the fear and loathing conversation. They all saw a bright future for themselves and not others, but they all saw a bright future. That's a great place to be in. We can have a non-hysterical conversation, a non-reactive conversation, a proactive conversation, and we should do it. So, how else would I refine this question? What it should be, the future of libraries and librarians. Here is an interesting reality that we live in. I would say we live in today, but the truth is we've lived in for some time. You can have a library without a collection, but you can't have a library without a librarian. If you have a librarian, a trained information professional who can understand people's needs and match information to those needs in an educative way, they can build a collection for you. This is in K-12 settings. We for a long time have talked about the notion of a school library media program, not a school library media center place. And the concept being that my library, my school, K-12 school, exists in your classroom. It exists when that student goes home after school. It exists for the lifespan of your connection with this institution. You have access to a library, even if you never physically walk into it. That means that these as institutions are important. These as institutions, as buildings, as places, as budget lines, as functions, as mythos, as legend, are important. But these are actually more important. I was on the board of a local public library. I love this public library, and this board was dedicated and loved this library as well. And one of the things that they were proudest of was the fact that they had increased the materials budget for the library by 20% every year after a huge budget cut. They'd been rebuilt it after 10 years. And the good times had come to an end, and now they were being asked to come up with cuts. And they looked at the 20% increase that they had budgeted for materials, and they said, what can we else can we do away with to keep that materials budget that high? And they looked at personnel. And someone had to stop them and go, if you don't have the people to put those materials on the shelf, to organize the materials, to help people get to the materials, to make sense of them, to pick the materials, to make sense of them, what good is the material? So you want 20% increase in stuff. I can get you 20% increase stuff cheap. You know, we have this book recycling program every year, and I can just shovel books into this building, and I can make your numbers go crazy. Funny story about that. The community I am has a book recycling program. You drop off these books. These bibliophiles went crazy on this. Karen Snyder has a great phrase from bibliofundamentalists. They're recycling books. They're getting rid of books. And they're like, how can we not do this? We can give them to the library. And the library said... And the library doesn't want to say, no, we don't want your damn books. So they say... So they shoot themselves in their foot. They say, we don't have the staff to manage that. And they say, we'll send you Boy Scouts to do it. And what's really hilarious is, would you actually go and see what's being recycled? They're like five books to every 20 issues of Hustler and Penthouse that are being recycled. Don't send the Boy Scouts! Don't know! So... what are the future of libraries and librarians? That's the education question. How do we prepare librarians? How do we continuously train librarians? How do we make librarians understand that their job is innovative? Here's the trick with librarianship. It's not done yet. A lot of what education systems set up is to teach you what's been done. It's like we know the answer. This is stupid. If you walk in and you have a professor who makes it seem like this is done and they have the answer, that is a bad professor. That's a bad professor. Their job is to be discovering what you need to know next, which, by the way, that room with all the academics talking about what is and what should be, someone ended the conversation by going, if we're training the next generation of librarians, shouldn't we be worried about what they have to deal with? What should be these? What should be the librarians? How do we prepare them? How do we continuously prepare them? I've been to several libraries now who've established 30-hour continued education requirements for their staff. And they're evaluated on it, and they're checked on it, and it's part of their performance review. And it's paid for. How do we do this on a regular basis? How do we get past the situation of, well, I went to ALA in 1937, and so I'm done. I know everything about cutter numbers. There is an electric pens. Last question. Last refinement to this question. These are just the introductory slides. In a democracy, and we've become so jaded that sounds very jingoistic. And yet I would argue that today it is more important than ever to put that context on it. Let's face it, we exist in a very interesting world where the concept of what does it mean for information in a democracy, this is an important question. If we're not going to talk about what the libraries, academic, public, special, school, what libraries' role in democracy is in an environment of the Patriot Act, when are we going to have that conversation? If we're not going to talk about what is the role of an information agent, a trusted and credible information agent, in the land of national security letters, in the land of habeas trials in front of the Supreme Court? If we're not going to have that conversation now, are we going to have a chance to have it later? This is another thing at a very strategic level. Very strategic. Actually, forget strategic. Very tactical level. That we need to get used to. I think librarians, by nature, including us, shy away from these big, grandiose concepts. I think they're uncomfortable for a lot of us to talk about. I think we get much more comfortable talking about the daily task and process and what Dewey stressed when he was organizing the American Library Association, which was efficiency. I think we spend a lot of time worried about process. And I think that oftentimes we forget that we are one of the most noble professions in this society. That librarians, I mean, it's hilarious. You know, I like all the jokes about the buns and the quiet and the shushing. You know why? Because on the other side of that comment is almost a reverence for what we do. I know it sounds weird, but if they're going to pick on you, at least you're important to them, right? I'm a Doctor Who fan. If anyone watches the new Doctor Who, they just had an episode where it was in the library, which was a planet-wide library, and how he knew something was amiss and wrong is it was too quiet. I love that, right? If we need to be able to say, you know what, you need us. Why do I need a library? We got all these bookshelves. You need us because you want to live in a land of freedom. Did you want to live in a land where people who are dedicated to understanding information are also dedicated to protecting your privacy and your understanding and your freedom in this environment? You need us not because what we can shelve up there. You need us because we can walk in and be trusted to tell you the truth. This notion that somehow we need librarians because we got more books to deal with is nuts. What we need librarians to deal with is because we have less truth to deal with. We are the credible sources. We are the rock upon, the pillar upon society. Education, free press, libraries are how we have organized and defined essential rights in this society. And we need to pick up and be willing to look at people and say, damn it, I'm important. All right. I have another way of phrasing this question for you. And it comes from a fellow by the name of Bill Arms, who's at Cornell, who, by the way, has his own views on libraries. He once did this great slide on the National Science Digital Library. And the title of the slide was "The Mortal in the Portal." This slide intentionally left blank. Bill, buddy. But he's at Cornell. He's at the Ivy League, so he knows what he's talking about. All right. But we actually invited him to come and talk about it in virtual reference days, talk about a research agenda. And over lunch, he came up with this great question. He said, imagine that you have a new president at Maryland. President? Chancellor? President? You have a new president. And your department, whatever it is, gets to send one star before the president to impress them. Right? So the econ department pulls out a Nobel laureate. Right, the physics department, Nobel laureate. Right, the computer science gets a Turing Award winner. What does the library send to the president to impress them? Right, what you want to do is be able to very quickly define for the president, for the president's investment, what is that fundamental and recognizable contribution that library science, that the library makes to this academy. Now, there's two parts to that. One, something I can look at and go, damn, that's good. The other is that everyone else, including the Nobel laureates and the Turing Prizes, can look and go, damn, that's good. Right? What is it that you can say, without a library, sir or madam, this is what the academy will be missing? Here is the contribution that we make to an academy. Who is that star? I don't care if it's a person. We can be all political about it, say, well, it's a group of people that do. I don't care. What's the story that you tell them besides, we buy stuff? Right? Oh, you got it. Or the best one. Why do we need a library in academia? Accreditation? Middle States is coming, right? Is it Middle States here? Who knows? Yeah. All right. Right? Well, everyone remember when Middle States was ready to throw out the library criteria? Now with outcomes, when it's no longer enough to talk about output, how many volumes have you circulated, what's your population, what's your volume count, now it's how did this improve learning of this student in this classroom? We're done with that answer. So what is that fundamental contribution that your organization makes to this institution? So there are the two questions that I think I give you to think about and ruminate on, and now I'm going to spend the rest of the time giving you my answer, but I still think that those questions are valuable in and of themselves. My answer comes out of something we've been working on for about 2 years now around this concept called participatory librarianship. And participatory librarianship, we were asked to do a technology brief on Web 2.0 and Library 2.0 and Education 2.0 and, you know, Dave 2.53 beta. And we started with the horrible, well, this is what a mashup is and this is what a social network is and all this other garbage. And he said, this isn't it. And the worst part is they were talking to, you know, myself and my co-author was Joanne Silverstein, and then Scott added, we're looking at each other going, we're not terribly social people. We're actually, believe it or not, introverts when it's not a crowd of 300. And who said, you know, we really don't get social networking either because I don't care if Tom's my friend. But we said, clearly some people do. There's got to be something more than vanity going on here. What's going on? So we were looking for a deeper concept. And what we came up with was something called conversation theory. We'll talk a little bit more about that in a second. But it has this central notion that knowledge is created through conversation. And this is not a metaphorical statement. This is a literal statement that means as I interact, and I'll define what I mean by conversation in a second, I'm learning what Gordon Pass would talk about as knowing. That the process of knowing something is the process of coming, seeking agreements and talking about it. Now, once again, give me a second to break that down for you. But stick with this idea that knowledge is created through conversation. If libraries are in the knowledge business, and I have few people who have ever objected to that statement, no, we're in the book business. No, we're in the building business. No, we're in the licensing database business. We don't own anything anymore, but renters are us. All right. If, in fact, we're in the knowledge business, we're in the conversation business. We're in the conversation business. All right, now it's important to tell you what I mean by a conversation, because I get yelled at. A conversation has four basic parts to it. Basic part one is it has conversants, people who are doing the talking. Now, conversants, Pask defined, that's Gordon there, Pask defined as cognizing agents. Ooh, ow, God, help us. I'm in Maryland, I can use big terms. The problem is, you know, what he's using is the fact that you and I can talk. That's a conversation. I and you can talk. You are, in essence, acting as one conversant, I am the other. So, and by the way, things are being exchanged. I'm looking around for one of these, I'm looking around for these, I'm looking around for one of these, I'm looking around for one of these, right? We're talking. But it can also go the other way. Libraries and vendors are conversants. Think about it. You go back and forth about what do you mean, what do you agree, all this other stuff. The party of the first part, the party of the second part. But it can go the other way. So those of you in the instruction game are used to terms like metacognition or critical thinking. We can, in essence, converse with ourselves. And a lot of our patrons do out loud by the reference desk. It makes them nervous. Right? So, you know, when you got up in the morning, you're like, well, traffic sucks, but if I'm late, I get this. And if I go left, I do this. And who are you talking to? Right? Does this tie look stupid? Do these pants look fat? Who are you talking to? You're talking to yourself. Right? It happens all the time. I mean, he was the guy who wanted to teach machines how to think. So he literally meant when I go like this, your eyes saw my hand go down, your ears heard the bang, you put them together and you literally say, does that mean that? Yes, I guess so. Those are the same thing. Boom. Right? So what are the conversants doing? Well, they're exchanging language back and forth. There's meaning and symbols going back and forth. Right? Now, language, I could break this down, but we're running out of time. Language can happen at multiple levels. It can be very directional. So if I get up here, for example, and start talking calculus, that would be funny. Let's be more honest. If one of you talked about calculus and you knew it very deeply, you might start talking about very concepts and interesting terms. I, as someone who never took calculus, might be really stupid. And so the conversation we have is rather limited. The language we can exchange, if you map it out, looks very directional. Do this, do that, do this. Think about it if you've been at the reference desk or if you've helped someone work systems or you've been the victim of someone who's helped you learn a system. Think about it. Good training looks like this. Well, you're going to do this because it's doing this and soon that's what's happening in the background. Bad training is click here, click here, click here. Goodbye. Right? Well, why? And if the screen ever changes, God help us. Right? My father, in the early days of computers, used to program database systems before things like graphics and mice. And so just for the hell of it, in the 80s, he used to put this big box in the middle of the screen and say, click here if you can. Right? It would just torture people that they didn't have a mouse. Right? So language goes back and forth. And by the way, it's interesting is think about the language that we as a library send out to novices and our students. Think about the catalogs as interfaces. If you understand the idea of classification, term collocation, hierarchical structures, you can work those systems like that. I mean, let's face it, you guys can work library systems extraordinarily well because you have a great understanding. So the language that you can understand, interpret, and send back to that system is very sophisticated. Someone who walks in and says, Library of Congress, huh? How much accommodation do we have for people who don't speak our language? or at the level. What are we doing with this language? We're seeking agreements. And if you've been in classes, you go, does that make sense? Is that all right? Right? Or in, I mentioned the idea of libraries and vendors, where you literally come up with a contract, where you codify these agreements. So we seek agreements. Well, if this is true, then this is true, then this is true, therefore this is true. This is how we build knowledge. These knowledge are things that we agree are fundamental and we can build and scaffold on from that. And these agreements are held in our memory, in what Pask would call an entailment mesh. And this is very important because what it means is when we hold these agreements, when we hold these bits of information, we hold them in relation to each other. Stupid example. Have you ever read a book, reread a book like 5 years after you read it originally, and you're reading the book and you go, I don't remember that. Or, I thought this was 20 pages, it was a half page. Or, who is that character? You come to interpret and understand the book radically differently because you have had conversations in between the first reading of the book and the last. That we come to understand things radically differently. So, why is it that I read to my son a book on Oh, the Places You'll Go by Dr. Seuss, and yet it was given to me upon graduation from my PhD program? One, my parents didn't have a very high esteem for my education. Or maybe there's multiple ways to read that book. Right? This is the situation that we're in. These agreements, this knowing, this entailment mesh, our knowledge changes. It's dynamic. It evolves. And so as we exchange knowledge, as we come up with agreements, we can move on. So after this slide, I can say, so a conversation, assuming that you got this slide. Assuming that I don't mean, oh, that means two people talking informally. No, no. This is what I mean by a conversation, right? This is how we build knowledge. We scaffold knowledge. Now, the reason I want to bring this up is a couple of things. The first is, one of the roles that a library can play in facilitating conversation is as memory holder. A lot of people, well, not a lot, several people have defined the library as the memory of the human story. The holder of the cultural record. Right? Lots of different phrases for it, but in essence it means you're our memory. Whose memory? So if this is the academy, this is our departments and our administration and our teaching and computing services and parking and all these things going on, and in there we're going to go ahead and put a professor, and I always recommend, by the way, if you have to use a professor, go with the top. A professor is busy working on research, is working on an article, is working on what have you. Doesn't have the information he needs. Everyone see the great studies, they're like 20 years old now, that talked about utilization of resource by geography, meaning that a professor will cite things that 80% of the things a professor cites are those in his own office. And it goes to like, you know, 5% if they have to walk down the hall. It goes to like, you know, 0.00001% if they have to do interlibrary loan. Right? So, he doesn't have it in his office, so what does he do? He goes to the library and says, I need it. And the library, through collection development policies, whatever, gets it. Now, what's interesting is we do this over time and time, and eventually, we're probably going to forget that link of how that book actually ended up in the stacks. Do you know the story of how every one of these books ended up in the stacks? Were some gifts? Were some just what Baker and Taylor sent us? Were some because this department needed it? Why are they there? We, in essence, disconnect the resource from the conversation. Now, what it means is, over time, what is the library remembering? It is remembering, it is capturing, it is storing all the things that are not the academy. It is all the information that isn't sitting in the offices and seeing the desks and seeing on the hard drives. It's everything that wasn't us. Well, what does that mean when suddenly that professor in an internet environment can, in essence, go right out to those external sources directly? What is the value of this memory when this memory can be maintained on its own independently? I'm not saying it's valueless. I'm just questioning what is that idea. Now, what I want you to think about is another model. And it's a model we've already started on. And it's a model that says, whose memory is this? It's actually, yes, some of this external stuff, but increasingly, it's the memory of what's happening internally. Where there's that professor, and that professor can still request that item and information. And by the way, remember that they asked us for that. But at the same time, why not, I don't know, go with open access initiatives so we capture their intellectual output directly through things like Harvard's open access initiative. I'm sure you guys have been debating that. What happened? Why are our professors signing away all their intellectual rights so we have to buy them back from Elsevier? Isn't this stupid? Help me, help me, help me. Okay. What's the value in me as a professor if we do that? What do I get out of it? I'll tell you, I think institutional repositories are a grand idea that we have implemented piss poorly. Clearly, I hold back my opinions. Okay. Why is it I think that institutional repositories should look much more like the Public Library of Science and peer-reviewed journals than they do look like DSpace and Dublin Core metadata of a bunch of buckets. I'm used to looking at peer review and how it's related and what conversations they're part of. Think about that. Why does a faculty member get a journal? Because they're tracking the conversation of their profession. If you take that thing, slice and dice it, break it apart, put it under some Dublin Core where they can no longer track what's an issue, what's a volume, who's the editor, what the peer review process was, it doesn't make sense anymore. Context, which is what a conversation provides you, is much more important than content. We can also, while we're at it, grab all their files. Websites. How many professors here are running projects where they've had to build a website for it? How many professors are qualified to build a website? Right? And what happens to those websites when the grant goes away? The information goes away. Why isn't it that they say, you know what, I really want a website for this grant, I'm willing to buy in some money for the library to maintain it because it's the information of the organization, you guys in the information business, host this stuff for me. How many of your professors are blogging? Can you tell me what they blogged? How many are podcasting? Can you tell me where they are? How much of this information disappears on a regular basis because our profession, our ethics, our standards are not applied to this because it's gray literature? Right? Also, what about archives? Helen Thibault down at North Carolina used to say, faculty are the worst archivists in the face of the planet. I bought a new computer. It's a Mac. Great. What was the other one? It was PC. Great. What happened to all your files? I didn't need them anymore. All the preprints, all the journals, all the information, all that document, gone. Oh, my hard drive wiped out. It's gone. Don't worry. Computing services will back it up. That's great. What will they do with it once it's backed up? What about a live archive? And yes, this is the one that people really look at me funny. Going through the library to get that external resource. Oh, please, Dave. What, are we going to become the internet service providers? No. Oh, yeah, like someone's going to stop in the library instead of going to Google. Let them go. But here are a couple of examples of different services that people have set up to capture that activity. Citation extraction. Every article that goes out through those open access journals, we're going to grab the citations out of them so we know precisely who's citing what resources. We're going to do things like social bookmarking. If you've looked at pen tags from the University of Pennsylvania, you can keep social bookmarks online so you can move from computer to computer. And those bookmarks aren't just websites, they're also articles, they're also licensed database resources, they're also your books. The library is providing that functionality. And in so doing, they are, in essence, capturing the conversations of the academy. Not getting in the way or slowing down or preventing, but capturing, understanding, remembering. Social citations. Pearl services. How many citations? I'll tell you mine. How many of my citations to my articles of the past 10 years are garbage now? I cited a web resource that no longer exists, or great, does exist, just radically different. Quick story. We did an interesting study called Reference Extract. We're hoping to do it again. And the idea was we grabbed all these URLs out of reference answers. All the librarians who were citing things, we grabbed all the URLs and we built it into a search engine. Wonderful idea. The data went back to 1992. Would you like to know where, I'm going to get the URL wrong, but it's okay. Autismforkids.org sends you? Porn site. A huge number of the links have expired or changed, been bought, changed to radically different information. Was I citing the porn site in my article? What about the idea of I just cited this thing, Marilyn goes out, grabs the copy as it exists at that point in time, puts it in a depository program, so it will always be the same information. All right. I want to show you another example of how this really begins to change how we build systems. And I'll pick on Syracuse, but if you laugh too loud, I will go ahead and I will bring Maryland's website up. We started with The reserves folks came to us and said, please, God, give us a better way of doing reserves, primarily because they were looking for a budget increase and wanted something sexy. But anyway, let's pretend they had good intentions. And they said, figure out the reserves. So here's the existing reserves system. Actually, right now you have to log into Blackboard first to keep us from being sued. So you go to find a reserve. That makes perfect sense. And for an 18-year-old, you end up with a page that looks like this, in which case you add your instructor, your department, your course, and you end up with a page that looks like this, right? Which is an alphabetical listing of all the stuff that professor put on reserve. Remember I said how memory is relational? It's a connection of agreements. This is not. Think about our library. Now, I want to be real clear. The library actually has a relational way of organizing its materials by its classification scheme, but it is one relation. And it is a very gross level, right? So we started thinking, how could we make this different? How could we take these concepts and apply it? And we came up with this. And I already tell you, this is garbage. So I'll tell you that before I go through it. This is garbage. But what we did is we looked at all the fabulous Web 2.0 stuff, and we threw it at this problem. So you've got your articles, you've got your books, you've got your classes, you've got your feeds, you've got your stuff, and you've got to have friends. Got to have friends. Got to have friends. That's a song, isn't it? So, I really, literally, MySpace, Tom, my only friend. So then you bring up your articles. There's the PDF. We started calling the screen the PDF glorification screen. All right? It screams Web 2.0, and I will tell you why it is completely useless. So there's the PDF file. Then you've got the basic bibliographic metadata. You can ask a reference librarian. That was cool. That's me, so good luck getting an answer. Then it's got to have a tag cloud. Tag cloud. Got to have a tag cloud. I love tag clouds. I really do. But let's face it, intuitive? Not always. Then library thing. We just stole that. That's library thing. And then Amazon. By the way, does your catalog system assume that you're stupid or the user's stupid? This is a standard question. You know how to tell? Put in a search that you know will give you zero results. At that, you will get a message. The message will either assume the user is stupid. Have you checked the spelling? Would you talk to a reference librarian? Or the library is stupid. Would you like interlibrary loan? Because clearly we couldn't meet your need, right? What about a third option? Add it. Okay. And before you say it, if they're looking for something they don't know, how are they going to add it? They can add a question, and then you can add the answer in there, and they can add a referral to it, and you can have a conversation going on. This is a PDF glorification screen. Why do people, what's the difference between an article and a book for someone who has a reserve in a class? Well, I can read, I'll read the article because I get electronically, I'll read the abstract of the book because I can't. All right. But seriously, what's the difference? Aren't books and articles part of classes? And what about feeds? And where's my schema for all this? So we went and said, no, this isn't it. And we came up with this. And here, think about a class. Is there any more pure example of a conversation happening in academia right now than a class? Someone comes in, the professor takes the time to, in essence, start the conversation through a syllabus. The syllabus is the first statement in a conversation. It's, this is, as a professor, how I see this topic, how it's organized, how we're going to go through it, and what materials are relevant. It's a relationship. If you look at a syllabus, it's a web. It's a map of a bunch of resources from multiple different domains pulled together for a specific topic. And what do we do at our reserve desk? Or we'll put it right next to all these other materials that you may or may not be able to see. But imagine, if you will, capturing the syllabi of academia and literally making them browsable online so you could click from topic to topic and book to book and material to material. You're capturing the conversations of academia. You're not simply capturing the output. So we have the syllabus, and the syllabus points to two resources. So now we know that even though this is a book on anthropology and this is a book on computer science, at least someone sees these as related activities. And then they have assignments, so I can begin putting my materials and my conversations. I saw this picture. I wanted to ask the artist what they did. So here's my email response. And suddenly the students put in their conversation. You can imagine me to a student. Imagine as a reference librarian getting something that looks like this, saying, I have a problem. The most insulting question that a virtual reference librarian can ask, have you searched Google? Duh. Right? How do you think I found you? Right? No, the right? Of course I did. Right? Now you can quickly, instead of starting to be, what do you need? What have you already looked at? But you can tell. This is how you see the world. well, have you thought about this and this resource and this edition? Have you tried that? You can suddenly see the thought. Because what they've had is a conversation, and they're inviting you in late to the game. But remember, they're inviting you into a conversation, not starting the conversation with you. That's a radically different situation. And then they click on one of these resources, then we can bring up the PDF glorification, but now it's in context, it's in relation, it makes sense. And what you can imagine happening over time is you begin to migrate materials from the repository of stuff, catalogs, really we should just call them what they are, inventory maintenance systems, to conversation systems. And so students, you can imagine saying, well, here's this book, I'm going to put my notes in. Can I see the notes of other students in my classroom? Yeah, I can read those. Can I see notes of anyone who ever has read this book? Oh, yeah, why is this book being discussed in this topic? I never thought about taking classes in that topic, and did you? And suddenly we're connecting things together. I get people, every time I talk about this, they always say, isn't it amazing how libraries were so worried about privacy and this kind of information, and this is the place that we used to take out the books, and they used to have that little slit in the back of them with everyone who's ever read that book? And in fact, you would read things based on who else had read the book? Oh, Tom read that. No, thank you. Right? Yeah. Right? That kind of connection, that kind of information, that kind of flow, suddenly you get things like, then people who read this, 9 of them read this. Maybe this is something you might want to look at. What's more of this really mean? More of this in the Dewey heading or a Library of Congress heading, or more of this as the conversations around this topic tend to go here? By the way, I mentioned before about being technology dominant. We were having this conversation at the Free Library of Philadelphia, and we were talking about what does it mean to facilitate conversations in a physical environment. And Todd Marshall, a doctoral student of mine, great, brilliant guy, came up with these different areas of what does it mean to facilitate. Well, first, we need to provide access to a conversation. So you can't have the conversation unless you can get into that classroom, unless you can get into this place, get into this online environment, understand how to use this computer, access. But it's only the first step. Knowledge. Once I get into that conversation, do I know what's happening? So one of the things we talked about in ALA land was I joined this committee. The committee's been around for 100 years, and I think most of the committee members have been there since the start. And so every time I raise an issue or, hey, can we do this, someone, there's always a historian on the committee, isn't it? What you need to realize is in 1928, when we tried that, it didn't work. Because we didn't have enough horses? I mean, what? So, knowledge. An environment that they can do it in. A lot of what we talk about in public and in academic spaces are safe environments. A lot of our discussion about Patriot Act is actually a safety question. You should feel safe and comfortable investigating knowledge where it takes you and not worried about people peeking over your shoulder. Right? An access environment. And a motivation. Do we recognize people for their contributions? Right? Identity management in libraries. There are two identities in libraries. Librarians and not librarians. And not librarians covers everyone from the president of the university to the maintenance guy. Right? Because why? Could the president of the university add a record to your catalog? Well, they can order us to, but still you're the one who's doing it. Right? Little power? I think so. Can we at least recognize people that may be able to do this? Right? So we talked about in access, what does it mean? Providing meeting rooms. How many people have meeting rooms like this? And we're building smaller meeting rooms, right? Providing sufficient bandwidth. Collecting of unique resources, providing long-term storage. What happens when that professor dies and you need to fill out that room? Where does that stuff go? Is it useful? Isn't it? Knowledge, training, mentoring activities, standing dissemination of information in pathfinders, environment, safe community norms, motivation, recognizing efforts. So we talked about the idea of, imagine now someone, a group, is working on a class project, and they come to the library and you give them a meeting space so they can all get together. Yay, we've done that. We've given them access, knowledge. They ask us for some resources. We provide it for them. But not everyone can make it to the meeting. Shouldn't we build hybrid classrooms so they can video conference with anyone on the internet to bring into that classroom as well? Mm-hmm. Right? What this presents is an opportunity gap. What academic libraries have right now is an opportunity gap. We are in the knowing business. We are in a business that spans discipline. And yet, a lot of the academic reward system for the faculty and such, it's a relatively simple algorithm. that you're taught either implicitly or explicitly as a new faculty member, which is take pond, divide pond until biggest fish is achieved, right? So Dave isn't just a library science guy. He's in reference. Oh, reference. Too many people in reference. Okay. I'm in virtual reference. Oh, damn. Why did Murray Radford go in that area? All right. I'm in systems. All right. Oh, man. There's someone else. All right. So if it's a Commodore 64 is doing virtual reference in 1968, I'm the expert. Give me tenure. Right? This idea that we take domains and we reduce them and we subdivide them until we become the biggest thing. Look around your libraries. My good friend is at the Art and Architecture Library. Right? Why do we have an art and architecture library? Because someone once decided that's different from everything else. And all right, so we'll take the art and architecture now. We've got art over here. We've got architecture over here. Architecture, we've got Bauhaus over here. And we keep subdividing the world until it fits a Library of Congress subject heading. But that's not how you learn. That's not how knowledge works. That sucks if you're ever going to be a Jeopardy contestant. Right? We learn from all across the... So we have our... group, our constituents, our members are being taught this. We have the opportunity for this. So someone comes in and asks a good physics question, and at the library we talk and we share and we cross boundaries and go, gee, that's really interesting. Did you know so-and-so in chemistry is working on that? Or did you know someone in computer science is working on a grant for massive manipulation of data? And you've got all this data. Hey, this is a connection we can make. We should be thrilled about multidisciplinary, interdisciplinary efforts because we are the interdisciplinary organ on campus. Why are we taking advantage of that? So, let me give you my answers. Answers to these questions. What should be the future of libraries and librarians in a democracy? And what is the fundamental and recognizable contribution of library science to the academy? Part one. One, libraries facilitate the knowledge creation of our communities through conversation. Universities are in the knowledge creation business. That's great. They should do that. Everyone has a different approach to it, from experimental methodology to theoretical methodology to domain methodology to core constituencies to professions they're aligned with. But the library is unique in that we do it specifically through fostering conversation, through communicating across disciplines and across concepts. And we don't do it in a reductionist way. We do it by bringing things together. We do this based on a deep conceptual foundation in learning and knowledge creation. We don't do the access is no longer an answer. If you are in the knowledge business, access is not a knowledge activity. That means if someone comes in and wants to know something, pointing them to the right shelf is insufficient for knowledge creation. If you want to do knowledge, you have to evaluate, you have to look at impact, you have to look at absorption, you have to look at the whole character and process going on. You can't simply be the people who provide the books around the problem. You must understand the problem. We do this with a series of skills and tools, everything from classification and pathfinders and reference work to XML and technology to literally facilitation skills. I think that we should become certified facilitators where we can come in and work with groups of students who've been told to work as a group. How many classes I've been to blame where we said this will involve group work. You guys, you're a group. Good luck. Right? And I'll tell you, at the end of the semester, it'll be you. We'll come in and say, I did all the work. They did nothing. Right? I deserve a different grade. We don't teach people how to work in groups. We simply make them work. Why can't a library sit there and go, you know what? Here's a process that we can put in place to help you with this. Here's how we can do it. We can divide it. We can do project management for these groups. But mostly, we do it through action. This is a conversation where we started talking about the notion about is or should be. What is the future of library versus what should be the library? We will determine and create that future. We will show you how we do things. We will not simply talk about it. We will not simply write a paper about it. We will not come up with yet another vision statement. We will just go ahead and change the world. That's what we need to do. But here is the real answer. What should be the future of libraries in a democracy? What is the contribution we make to the academy? That's up to you guys. This is really, I can't tell you the number of people who come up to me after this and go, oh, Dave, great talk. If only I didn't have such an idiot for a supervisor. Often I know the supervisor, so yeah. Oh, you know, you're right. We should get rid of all this and we should do all these brand new services, but there's no way my director will go for it. We seem to think, for some reason, libraries are like invented by God and put on the earth as if it wasn't a human-developed thing. As if this organization isn't literally the people in this room. That somehow org charts outweigh common sense. That somehow we believe that our titles define us. Ultimately, you are responsible for what is the future of this library and what it should be. And I don't care at what level. I was in a situation, I was talking with a fundraiser, and this fundraiser was in tears, mad and in tears at the same time, saying, we have to go out and we have to raise all this money. And to do that, we need innovative new services. And so our staff of three do it, and those hundreds of librarians sitting over there don't. We want them to. We want them to lead us. We want them to tell us what's new. We want them to tell us what we should be doing. We can no longer sit back and wait to find out what is the future of libraries. To do it is to abdicate a responsibility. It's a professional responsibility, but it's a larger, noble mission to this institution and this society that says we are in the knowledge and change business. It is our job every day to make people's lives better. Every one of you has the story. That story where you change someone's life. That story that you cherish and in the hard times of committee work and team leadership, you drag out about when you change someone's life. Maybe it was giving them the best book they ever read. Maybe it was getting them in charge of a homeless shelter. Maybe it was getting them the grade on their paper. But it was something. And it started with a conversation. That story that I hear over and over again, that I cherish, never starts with, I was sitting back and someone slid the book from the shelf and I knew I had it. It's about you. This institution is about you. This crap about we're doing collections for the next generation in 100 years. This thing about tradition and that somehow these walls prevent us from coming up with innovation and change. That somehow our history is a chain that binds us to the wrong way is garbage. It is your job to figure out what's new. We're not done. And you can rely on me all you want, and I'll give loud speeches, but I leave at 8 o'clock tonight, and I'm not going to get it done. It's you. And you don't have to be loud and obnoxious to do it. You do have to care. You do have to be creative, and you have to have a voice. If you have a director who doesn't listen, yell louder. If you have a supervisor that doesn't understand, take their job. I can't tell you the number of people, oh, I don't want the management job. I enjoy this too much. It's too bad. There's an obligation for leadership. There's an obligation to look at something wrong and fix it. And we can no longer sit back and say, well, we're librarians. We don't do that because we're the fundamental bulwark to society in terms of being a trusted information source. That's your responsibility. That's your job. That's my responsibility. That's my job. If we're obsolete in 10 years, it's our fault, not someone else's. Thank you very much. Questions? Yes, please.
So what would it look like to have library service in a kind of a conversation-rich environment?
I'll give you the cheesy answer, and then I'll give you the real one. The cheesy answer is it depends on the community you're serving. So I was talking with a librarian who worked at a small all-women's liberal arts college up in the Northeast, and she says, we don't do virtual reference, almost ashamed. I said, why? And she goes, at 9 o'clock at night, everyone comes in their slippers and PJs and does study group, and that's where we do our reference work. I said, don't offer virtual reference, right? So giving one answer is not going to work. But my guess is an academic environment at this size, what it's going to look like is a lot of distributed services, embedded librarians working directly with departments on research teams, not liaisons who show up to faculty meetings once a month. It's going to look like things like tenure services that look like this. We're going to get a list of everyone who's coming up for tenure this year. We're going to knock on that faculty member's door, and we're going to say, we'll be doing your citation analysis for you. This is great because, one, if they get tenure, you are a hero. And if they don't, they leave and they can't fathom it. But, and by the way, in terms of reaching students, reach faculty. Faculty will push the students to you. Right? And they're here for a lot longer. So when you hear a lot of my stuff talking about faculty, it's not just complete self-centeredness. A lot of it is. But it's also that tactic. I think it looks a lot like roving reference in physical environments. And I do think it looks like physical spaces with lots of communications and snacks and such. But I think if you were to look at something in 10 years that embraced this idea, where you would see the most radical change is online. Because I think we're moving this way in our physical libraries and our online environments need to catch up. I think it's going to look like library catalogs that are much more looks like course management systems than they do catalogs. I think that we're going to be looking at a lot of hosted services through the university that will be hosted through the library. I think this notion of every time a faculty member wants to blog, they should be blogging with something hosted by the library. Because in conjunction with computing services, I mean, that's politics. But the point is that information will be there for a long time and can be found. I think that it will look a lot like embedded teams where there's a lot of cross-communication. Now, I want to be really careful because I've had conversations with librarians who've been in team management situations, and that means more meetings, and that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about a lot of this is us eating our own dog food, which is we need to embrace these kind of participatory online tools for our own communication, sharing, and planning. So these brain boxes that we have hidden underneath our reference desks, that's the one where we got the hard questions, we wrote down the answer in case it ever came up again. Let's put them online and share them. Right? It looks a lot like a strategic planning process that does not start with 50 librarians coming together and talking about what do we do well. And it looks a lot like 50 librarians walking with clipboards out to every department and saying, what are you talking about? I don't want to know what you do with the library. This is not a library usage question. This is a conversation analysis. What are you talking about? What research are you working on? What issues are you dealing with? Curriculum development? What student issues are you dealing with? Policy development? And by mapping those, we can then say, well, here are the resources that we can feed that service. And not walking in once a month at a faculty meeting going, I'm the library in case you need us. Right over here. What you do is you walk in and say, you know, Bob's working on this effort of a curriculum reform, and we've got five models from five different universities that we researched and gave you topics on. So a lot of it is, it could look, I think online is going to look radically different. I think in our physical spaces it's going to look somewhat different with a lot of communal spaces. But I think in the processes by which we communicate with our constituents, it will also look radically different because it's based on what they're talking about, not on when they come to see us.
So where do you see academic libraries intersecting with the community and working with public libraries?
First of all, let me clarify myself, which is when I say community, I literally mean your service community. So that could be a geographic community, and the University of Maryland is a community. Agriculture people are community. Anyway, but you're right. The lifelong learning is very interesting because if you look into public library usage statistics, it's this lovely mound, right? Young kids come in for story hours, disappear, and then they come in to bring their kids for story hours, and then they disappear, and then they come back for a knitting circle, right? You know, so I guess it's three, right? And what happens in that middle trough is that school libraries and then university libraries see this bump, right? And so the question is, are you the public library for your students? This is a really, we have a college up in Syracuse, not Syracuse University, Lemoyne, and they really started doing a huge collection around popular media, DVDs and CDs, because they realized these kids are sort of stuck in Syracuse, New York, and they're on campus and they need public library service. And so their answer was to use a big part of their budget to do it. Sitting, I swear to God, 100 yards was a public library branch that they never talked to. Right? So I think the question is, when you map out those, thank you very much. When you map out those conversations and when you see what they're talking about, you know, when they're talking about what to do on Friday night, I'm not sure you actually want to answer that question. I'm not sure they would even care to know what your answer is. But if you can build a network of people who could answer those questions, I think partnerships with public libraries make a huge amount of sense at the student population level and joint services. And like I say, it's amazing. When you talk to a public librarian, you might be surprised to know they're librarians too. There's a lot of overlap with the kinds of things you do and the topics you talk about. So I think there's, in the San Jose Joint Service output and such, I think that's a very situational dependent thing. They've been successful. I think a lot of the reason they've been successful is their director makes it successful. So. Yes. And they let you in.
National Public Radio.
Oh, very good.
So, I think at this time in our careers, we kind of get it. But 10 more years, we're going to be hopefully retired. So.
Can you coast for 10 years? Is that where we're going here?
So I wonder, are you teaching students this kind of issues? Are library schools teaching our students the skills that they need, like project management, for example?
Yeah.
We never learned project management.
Right. I think that there's a couple of things going on. First of all, cramming everything into 2.5 years is tough.
Sorry.
I'm sorry, yes.
For something so basic, like, are you teaching students how to articulate these issues? Because when we learned stuff, nobody told us how to speak in public. Nobody told us how to, understand the organization where our life is going to be. The budget lessons, the classes that we had were useless.
Mm-hmm.
So are you teaching that kind of thing for the future? Those are the tools, the basic tools.
They are the basic tools. And there's this interesting simmering, and it's interesting, if you go into literature, it's been simmering for literally a century, of discontent between the profession and the education field. I mean, for a century, people have said they don't get it, whichever side they're on. And I think a lot of the problem recently comes less from the fact of who gets what to 2.5 year, 3 credit cycles to fit things into. Economics, for example, we can't offer special courses with less than 20 students. Less than 20 students, we can't teach a course for economic reasons. That business model, which is geared around 2.5 years, makes it virtually impossible to satisfactorily prepare someone for the domain. And so what happens is there's this general understanding of, as a library school, we'll teach them some deeper concepts, we'll teach them a lot of technology, and then they're yours. And through the trial of fire, you'll pick up the rest. And you guys are noticeably and rightfully pissed about that. And we are noticeably and rightfully pissed that you're pissed about that, right? Because we only had 2.5 years. Give me a break. Right? So as long as we're stuck with that cycle, and by the way, who determines that? ALA accreditation, which is a membership profession-driven organization. I'm sorry, did I sound pissy? I did. I think we need to radically rethink it. The other problem we have is that we teach them in isolation. So we say, all right, come up with this brilliant project. Student comes up with a brilliant project, writes a paper on it. I give them an A because it sounded brilliant, and they walk away. It's a frictionless environment. As opposed to, that's a brilliant project. Here's your manager. He's an idiot. Good luck. Right? Or here's a manager. They're brilliant, but you have no money. How do you work? A lot of this is, I could teach project management, and I can teach communication skills. But if I teach it in divorce of reality, the retention on that's going to be relatively low. And one semester internships are insufficient to truly break that down. So when you talk about different types of partnerships, library schools and libraries, where they really have an honest-to-God partnership, where you could spend half of your education or all of your education in a library, not as an apprenticeship program, not producing clones of yourself, but as an environment where they can make new ideas, so the library benefits from new ideas, and learn, how do I present this appropriately? How do I have to plan it out? What are the issues? That benefits the students in the schools. The information schools that also get a lot of hassle because they've gone from library science schools. The first wave was library science schools that took on computer science schools. I think the next wave is going to be information schools taking on communication schools for just this issue. But the number one thing lacking out of curriculum across the board, including at Syracuse, I'm perfectly willing to pick up, is what I call subversive radicalism. We need to teach change agents, not leadership. We don't need to give someone a grand vision saying, this is the future. Here's a wiki. Good luck. What we need to teach is, here's the establishment. Here's how you, in essence, win over the establishment or overthrow the establishment to implement new ideas. And I'd love to say we're teaching those, And I think we try in a lot of ways. A lot of it is constrained by the structure we have before us, but we should do a better job. And to do a better job, we need, I'm pointing as if you were all just academic librarians waiting to help me, but you guys need to come back from the field on a regular basis and say, I'm going to mentor them, I'm going to volunteer them, I'm going to guest speaker them, because in distance education classes, you don't have to physically go anywhere, or I'm going to sit down with you on a regular basis and yell at you. I don't mind being yelled at from someone who wants to make a change. So we're not doing a good enough job. There are some reasons we're not doing a good enough job that we should address, but ultimately we should do a better job at teaching communication skills, project management, and like I say, subversive radicalism. Yes?
You mentioned earlier the possibility of a continuous education requirement, and wouldn't that help accomplish some of this of creating a feedback loop from someone in the profession coming back into the educational environment, even if only for a
Absolutely, and not even for a three-credit class. So there are some leadership institutes offered that are brilliant, from Urban Library Council, from, I'm sure, ARL offers these kinds of things. The idea is that we need to make this on a regular basis, and we need to make them economically viable. And for that, we need to write them into systems to make that happen. So, no, when I talk about a continuous education system, this isn't a professor permanent employment act. This is really the idea of looking at the range of education. One of the programs I really love is in North Carolina State University with their fellowship program, where they go out to schools and they find the best students. They hire them in for, I think it's a two-year fellowship where they rotate them with like a real job and then a crazy half job. And they rotate the real job around and they end up hiring half the folks that they bring. But that notion of early leadership academies in academic and libraries are great. Comma. One of the problems we have to deal with is a dysfunctional innovation system within libraries, which is we hire innovation. How many people have been the young librarian? Has no idea what the age. Oh, Dave, great idea. We need to talk about that with Jan. We need to talk about that with Billy. We just hired Billy. He's young. He's great. He could be 98 years on oxygen, but he's the new librarian. Right? He's the young guy. And what happens is, it's like, oh, we hired someone who knows wikis. Now we don't need to know wikis. That's a problem. That if we constantly look at the new people with the least amount of cultural knowledge, the least amount of political power, the least amount of experience, as the people who are going to bring the most important thing we do, which is figuring out our future, that's a problem. So, yes, we need leadership academies, but they also need for new folks, but also for folks who've been there a while, that we can regularly make sure that they update their skills. So I think, you know, this library was at with it, where they implemented a 30-hour, it was for every librarian. It wasn't for the new folks. It was for every librarian. Manager, director title, didn't matter. You were going to do 30 hours of continuing that. Yes? All right, I got to show you a slide, so hold on just 1 second. Yeah, I'll do it this way. Oh, which one? Yeah, I'll pick on Cornell. Yeah, this will work. I know we got to go, so I'm sorry I'm keeping you. This is, we've all been on that committee. This is the entire screen for Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone from OCLC WorldCat. You can read it at your leisure. Right, so not just the top screen, the whole thing. This is the entire record from the Onondaga County Public Library, National Library of Australia, Library of Congress. And invariably, you've been on this committee. Our website sucks. We've got to make it better. We've got to make it more like Amazon. We've got to make it more like Google. Remember when Yahoo forced everything in the world to be 13 categories on our homepage, and now Google makes it have to be one box? right? So it's got to be simpler, easier, less stuff, less complicated. Ready for Amazon? Same book. What is it? Well, it's all marketing stuff, right? That's marketing and branding, plus their search interface. That's sales information such as price and publisher. This is some additional sales recommendations they have for you. Quality reviews from the New York Times Book Review, these kind of things. Bibliographic data. If you add that light blue and that orange together, you're not far off from those. So what else is going on here? Recommendations based on what you've already previously purchased. Open reviews. Conversations. What you're finding is more pathfinders. What else are you finding? Discussion tools. And only at the end you get more branding. What you're seeing is not simpler from a less screen real estate. You're seeing more natural, which is they want to have a conversation and they're seeing conversations. And if you read these reviews on Amazon, read them. My guess is you'll find about 50% or more aren't really talking about that book. They're talking about, like in Harry Potter, if you read the reviews, like, this is a great book because what J.K. Rowling does is she sets stuff up here that you don't understand until you're in book 7 and book 5. Are they talking about book 1? No, they're linking and creating these conversations across these resources. It's just that Amazon does what we do, which is we say, everything's about a thing, instead of flowing the conversations. Amazon, it makes sense because they want to sell you the thing. Here, it doesn't make so much sense because we're not selling the thing. We're trying to get them to the best information. So, one, I think this notion of chasing Amazon and Google is a problem because, one, we're not actually chasing what they're really doing. And, two, if you chase these, you will always be the second best. If you try and be Amazon, you will at best be the second best Amazon because they always get to win. Right? We need to stop the line we used to use, is stop riding waves of innovation and start becoming the wave machine where we create our own innovation based on knowing how people work. Your second question about sending people off to other libraries, I think this notion is great. This was a lot of what sat behind virtual reference was get people to the best resource. And within communities, I talk about the idea on some talks about people going in and adding comments to the catalog, and they're like, I'm in Syracuse, New York. I don't want anyone from Okinawa, Japan adding comments to my catalog. Don't let them. I talk about you serving your community. If your community is the universe, good on you. My guess is the best you guys can do is really justify as the citizens of Maryland, because you're probably land grant, right? So citizens of Maryland if they're trying to grow something. But this notion of knowing the community and then functioning as the community does. If you're in this Department of Justice Law Library, their catalog went down for 3 months and they received 5 complaints. Why? Because most of the people they were serving, the 300 and some people they were serving, were lawyers. And when lawyers wanted something, what did they do? Hop on the catalog? Jenny, Bill, Fred, whatever. Could you get me this book? I don't care how. I don't care where. Right? The librarians were their interface. So when they talked about innovating, and they were originally talking about building a better portal-like interface within the catalog, I said, that makes no sense. None of your users are there. It's better to spend more resources getting them a faster speed dial to you, right? Or getting email service where they have your email on their intranet, or bookmarking tags in Firefox when they're searching Google, right? Know thy community. You know that, for example, when a faculty member comes in to ask you a question, they could use probably an hour worth of reference. They don't know they need it, but they could use an hour's worth of reference sort of understanding their concept. When an undergraduate 18-year-old walks in looking for an article with the titles because they've been assigned to it, and you could just hand it to them and be done if you wanted to. Who are we trying to serve? What languages and what systems are we using to serve them? Where are the communities occurring? Let's be at the point of the communities. Are they in the dorms? Where are we in the dorms? These kinds of things. So, I don't know if I ever got anywhere near your question, but thanks for asking it. One last one. I know I'm kept you over time. Well, again, I thank you very much for your time, and I appreciate your input and comments.